Thank you very much. I've worked in prison since 75, so that's about 30 years. I helped start the Gay and Lesbian Health Service here in Brisbane with David Orth. I run a group called GLADS, Gay and Lesbian Alcohol and Drug Support Group, and we've been running that since 1991, about 16 years now. And I run another group called MARS, Men Affected by Rape and Sexual Abuse. And so I've cared for about 970 men who've been raped or sexually abused. I work with victims and perpetrators, male and female victims, male and female perpetrators. And so most of my work is AIDS, drugs, prisons, rape, sexuality. So that's my background. And I'm very fortunate because I get to learn from the people that I work with. And it's a two-way benefit because I listen to them and we learn from each other. I'm going to share stuff with you that I've found really useful, especially about relationships. We all are human. We all live and exist in relationships. And I'd like that those relationships could be optimal in meeting our needs. I'm going to start with a story. Father and son were watching television and something gay came on the television. And father said, "Those effing poofters should line them all up and shoot them." There was no verbal response from son, but son's body language tensed up. And Dad knew immediately that son was gay but couldn't talk about it. He was only 17, and because he couldn't talk about it at home, the burning desire to find fulfillment of himself and connection with people that he could be himself with meant that he ran away from home. When he ran away from home, he found himself not having any supports. You know, no extended family, no people you can talk to about how's your day or what's happening or what you're learning about. And so in seeking to be accepted by other people, he found himself taking risks, risks that probably you just want people to accept you so you don't care about the risks and you do things so people will like you. And with that, plus not having any knowledge about the risks of HIV or AIDS, meant that the risk-taking and the lack of knowledge meant that he became HIV positive. He didn't know he was HIV positive until he landed himself in hospital with meningitis. When he came to hospital with meningitis, they diagnosed that he had HIV/AIDS as well. And so when he became conscious enough to be able to phone home, he phoned home and said, "Mum and Dad, I'm in hospital, I've got meningitis, I've got AIDS, and I'm gay." I know the story to be true because that person was Jeffrey, my boyfriend. He died in 1994, and Mum and Dad went from people who he thought were homophobic to people who backed him all the way. And all through his illness, from the day of the phone call, they couldn't have done more to support him and love him and care for him and show him that he was their son and that they cared about him. It was a hard journey because those times in the early 90s and late 80s, we didn't have much treatment for HIV, and so ultimately when he did die, Mum and Dad asked me to conduct the funeral, and I said, "Yeah, I'll do it," because I wanted it to be personal and true to who he was. But Dad said, "I don't want you to use the word gay or HIV in the funeral." And I said, "Well, I hear what you say and I accept your fear, but Jeffrey rose above the stigma of HIV and he rose above the stigma of being gay." And Jeffrey said to me, he said, "Wendell, the quality of my life after diagnosis was better than my life before diagnosis." And you'd think, how could your life be better with AIDS? But it was better because he moved from being afraid to be honest to being free to be honest. And because he was free to be honest, he ended up with what's called true friends rather than pretend friends. And he was able to connect rather than hide. And so, of course, the quality of life was better because he got true friends and true love and true freedom. And so I said, "I'm going to honour Jeffrey's life, not by making a big thing about it, not by rubbing it in your face, not by trying to change people's views, but just by respecting the fact that he rose above stigma, he rose above prejudice, and he rose above the fear of death to be able to be free to be himself." And, of course, Dad was able to respect me, and Dad could then share with me the story of the pain of watching television and seeing his son's body language tense up. And Dad had carried that shame and that pain and that guilt right until after the death. And it wasn't that Dad didn't love son. And it wasn't that Dad actually would be rejecting of son. It's just that dad had sent a message that son then presumed that dad would be rejecting, and so then son had to hide from dad. In relationships, we often get trapped because we think, well, is it my fault or is it their fault or whose fault it is? And we could get stuck in blaming, but I don't find much relief in blaming. You know, if I blame you, you go to your corner. If I blame me, I go to my corner. Standoff, communication breakdown, no room to move, no solutions. And so I think blaming individuals is very counterproductive when it comes to looking at how we relate to each other and how we want to relate better. I much rather look at interaction rather than look at individuals. And so I'd like to say, if it's healthy, it'll serve both of us well. If it's not healthy, it's not going to help either of us. Let's put any energy we have into healthy. Let's not put any energy into unhealthy. And so I'll share with you a model, and I'll ask the our technician helper, thank you, to put up a model on the screen about relationships. And we could have a whole workshop on it today, but we've only got a short time. First of all, we'll look at what makes healthy healthy. And then we'll have a look at what makes unhealthy unhealthy. I think the foundation of healthy is when you feel accepted. And when you feel accepted, you feel then like to open up and communicate. If you think I won't accept you, do you feel like opening up? No way, it's the last thing we do. And so the opposite of acceptance is rejection. And in response to rejection, we put up the wall, we hide, or we get out the gloves and we fight. And so when I see hiding and fighting happening in relationships, I think, oh, maybe we don't have the safe foundation of acceptance. And if we want to nurture communication, the most effective thing we can do is go back one step, and rather than saying it again or saying it louder, is to go back to just let that person know that we accept them. The easiest way for me to show acceptance is just to listen to you. When I listen to you, you think, oh, Wendell's treating me as a valuable person. He thinks I'm important. He's giving me some time. He's listening. Listening might be painful, but it's the most efficient thing we can do to foster communication. If when I have shared with you, you still accept me, then I can relax and trust. And so this is the way to A, accept, C, communicate, T, trust, the way to act to get the best possible relationship we could get. Often when communication doesn't go well, we hear no instead of yes. We don't like no, and so we think, oh, this person's saying no, they must be rejecting me. Oops, up go the wall, out come the gloves. And so we often misinterpret honesty as rejection. When I get a no, I like to say, oh, thank you for being honest. I wanted a yes, but I'm glad that you're friend enough to be honest to my face. And so I go from the message that I don't like back to acceptance and confirm that, yes, we are friends enough to be honest to each other's face. And we may not agree, we may not have the same choices, we may not have the same opinions, and why would we? Because we come from different backgrounds and see things from different angles. It's natural that we see things differently, and that's good. We're not all same, we're all different, and that's good. And if we can accept and value each other, then we can use that safety to untangle the misunderstandings that come from being honest with each other. I hear what you say, I don't understand what you mean, but I'd like to understand. I'd like to understand as an acceptance or valuing message. And there's no loss in understanding another person. Some people think that this trust thing comes from just being totally honest, but I could use the truth to bang you over the head and to make you feel very non-accepted. I could bring up your past and make you look like a bad person, and often we do that. We keep ledgers about who's the goodie and who's the baddie and bring up all the debts to bang each other over the head when we want to win an argument. What's the good of winners and losers if we don't have friends? And so honesty without acceptance is just pure vulnerability, and people will never be honest if they feel that they're going to be rejected. Equally, acceptance without honesty can't produce trust. And if we think we have to sacrifice honesty to show acceptance and just say what people want to hear and agree with them to shut up to keep the peace and say yes to their face and do no behind their back, we won't get trust out of that. We'll end up being pretend friends. And we can be good pretend friends, but it will never meet our needs adequately. And so I'm simply saying that to get this trust safety outcome, we need to value each other and listen to each other. We need to be able to be comfortable to be honest with each other because it's safe, and then we get the trust outcome. In lovers, when we feel accepted for our whole self, we're able to then share our whole self, our words and our bodies. And so then trust takes the form of intimacy where you can relax and you can be yourself together without fear of rejection, without pressure of competition. You don't have to outperform the last lover or the next lover. You can just be yourself together. And I think that's what we all long for, but it's more than that, it's what we all deserve. In healthy friendships, we accept each other, we're honest with each other, we don't trick or trap, we don't lead each other up the garden path. And so, because you're honest with me and I'm honest with you, we know where we both stand. Trust now takes the form of understanding. We may not always agree with each other, but that's okay because we can value each other and be honest. I like to think about healthy enemies. I've talked about healthy lovers and healthy friends. Healthy enemies. Healthy enemies accept each other's right to live and have a body. They don't have to kill each other. Some of my patients haven't quite achieved that. But if we could value each other, we could be honest. And if you being you is a threat to me being me, we give each other enough space and enough time that we don't be a threat to each other or devalue each other or rob each other the right to make choices or have freedom. And so trust between enemies is called respect. Where I respect your right to live and choose and be. I may not agree with you, I may not have warm feelings about your choices, but I value you enough to give you the freedom to make those choices. So that's healthy lovers, healthy friends, healthy enemies. It's also a healthy group. I run a rape recovery group and a drug recovery group. I simply create an accepting space where people can make their own decisions, talk when they want to, leave when they want to, work out their own issues in their own way and not talk if they don't want to. And because people feel safe, they are honest early rather than late. They can come out of that rejection, hiding, fighting thing, that the survival thing we do, to get better relief than their drugs or better relief than the secrecy that they put on the rape in the past. When people feel safe, they love to be honest. In fact, sometimes they tell me more than I ask them. Then they can relax and heal and regain their value and regain the freedom to have safety in their relationships. This is also healthy self. When I could feel valued and accepted, then I'm free to be honest. Honest about my needs, honest about my limits, honest about my past. People who don't accept themselves and are honest about their past might kill themselves out of guilt. And if you're honest about a mistake and you hate yourself, guilt's a big risk factor. People who don't accept themselves aren't honest about their limits. They try and be Superman or Superwoman and they go past their limits, don't trust themselves, find themselves not feeling safe, feeling out of control. And if you feel that you have to be a people pleaser where you say yes so people like you, you'll go past your limits and then, oops, you can't sustain it and, oops, you can't deliver it and, oops, you feel burned out or worn out. And so love includes valuing each other and giving each other freedom to be honest, including saying yes and no. People hear me say the word acceptance and think, oh, if I accept people, I have to compromise my honesty. No way. When we accept each other, it makes honesty easier, not harder. And if we can value each other and both be honest, we can agree to disagree. It doesn't have to, acceptance never sacrifices honesty. It nurtures honesty. When I accept myself, I can be honest about my sexuality. If I don't accept myself, I'm not likely to be free to be honest because I'm scared people will reject me. My need for acceptance is deeper than my need for honesty, and so I'll deny who I am. I might even get married to prove that I'm not gay. The living in fear of if I'm honest I'm going to get rejected means we're not free to relax and trust, and people who don't address their need for personal value and integrate their personal truth with that value don't get to be safe people, and that's high-risk suicide. And that's the deep cause of suicide. People feeling that they're not going to be valued if they're honest. And so if we're going to reverse that risk, we need to value people and respect honesty so it makes it safe, so people can be valuable and free. That's healthy. I do that first because I'm an optimist and I like to give you hope. We'll now have a look at unhealthy. You might identify quite strongly on this side. If so, that's okay. That means we're both human. I don't want you to be scared. It's not about the goodies and the baddies. It's about what does give us relief as opposed to what can't give us relief, even if we're good at it. In an unhealthy relationship, we found ourselves bonded together through need. I need you, you need me. At the beginning, we think, wow, this is wonderful. This person meets my needs. I feel valuable because they love me. The danger is that if it's just a need-based relationship alone, when the needs aren't met, we feel lousy. And if the needs aren't met, we might just get stuck with denying those needs, putting up a big wall, living in a fortress, not letting people close, pretending to be somebody who we're not, hiding, maybe acting straight so we don't fob off the people who might reject us if they knew the truth. And so that denial process is a very survival mechanism. The The denial is the reaction to the fear of rejection. Denial of a need can never adequately meet a need, and I just become a shell instead of a person, and I feel very safe and very lonely. Because denial never works adequately, the risk is that I find myself then going outside that wall to try and get my needs met by using other people. And some people use each other in many different ways. Some people try and buy each other. I was nice to you, so you should be nice to me. I bought you dinner, so you owe me sex. Or in a parent-child relationship, I've sacrificed all my life for you, so you should do what I want you to do so that I feel successful producing a little child that will do exactly what I want them to do. It's called a puppet and a puppeteer. And if we try and buy people, we're actually trying to obligate them to do what we want to meet our needs. And what happens with obligation is that instead of feeling accepted and free to be honest and say yes or no, we feel obligated and we feel we have to say yes to please people. And out of obligation, people sacrifice honesty trying to get their needs met to get accepted because they feel they owe somebody something. This is very evident in my work with people who've been raped or sexually abused. When they don't feel accepted and free to say yes or no, they might find themselves feeling pressured or feeling obligated. They have to say yes out of fear or yes out of obligation or yes to keep the roof over their head. An alternate parent-child relationship is, hey kid, I accept you, including your need to make mistakes and learn. I'll accept your need to make those choices. If you don't like the outcomes, let's talk about it. And so it's building a friendship that we can use to work through life's issues. Sometimes parents feel that they have to model a perfect person to feel that they're being the perfect role model. And they're so perfect that the child will think, oh, I have to hide my mistakes from my parents because I'm going to get rejected or I'm going to hurt mum and dad or I'm going to let them down or be a burden to them. I think if parents can model real rather than perfect, and if they can model honest rather than super person, they're giving their child a gift that they're real and that they're accessible and they're happy to talk. And I say to parents, if your child can be honest with you, you are successful, even if you don't like what you're hearing. Because if your child's safe enough to feel accepted enough to be honest with you to your face, you may not like what you're hearing, but you've sent them a special message that you are a valuable person. And the most important people in the whole world to help us feel valuable are our mum and dad. And if we don't learn that, we'll be seeking acceptance from peer group or acceptance just by trying to be super person on our own and trying to think we're only successful when we're rich or famous or straight. And I have patients who are rich and famous and straight, but they don't feel valuable or free. Another way we might use each other is to try and manipulate each other, where we try to change the other person to meet our needs. You treat me badly, I'll teach you a lesson, I'll treat you badly. My experience is that two people treating each other badly always makes it worse. So it's a dead end. And we can get good at manipulating the other person to try and extract love. But if I just make you scared of me, I won't feel loved even if I'm good at making you scared. And so true love is about valuing each other enough to be honest with each other, again, to give choices, to let people meet the consequences of choices and learn from them, so that we can learn and grow together, and to be saying, hey, if you don't like it, let's talk about it. Another way that people use each other is to have power over each other. And people who don't value themselves are most likely to use power as a substitute way to feel good. And some of my patients in jail are very power-dependent people. They find themselves always needing to be on top to feel safe, and they want to get on top before someone else does. And power and denial are the things that people use most if they don't feel valuable enough to be free to be honest, because to be honest is to be vulnerable. But to be vulnerable, we need to be safe. Otherwise, people resort to their fortress or to their power games, and they get good at winning. One of my patients was in jail, and the jail was very crowded, and he had to share his cell with another person. The person who is sharing his cell with was a murderer. And he was very scared to share his cell with a murderer, especially because the person who he was sharing the cell with had murdered a gay man. So he was very afraid. Luckily, he was gay himself, the guy doing the sharing. Luckily, they got to be friends. And so the friendship that they shared by valuing each other opened up the door to be honest. And it turned out that the murder had happened after someone had gone from the Roma Street beat just over the river, gone home with someone and had sex. After the sex, the person who didn't accept themselves and wasn't free to be honest had their denial about their sexuality smashed by the sex. You know, reality is a good thing to smash denial. We can't sustain denial when reality smashes it. And so after the reality of the sex, he couldn't deny that he was gay, and so he wanted to then blame the other person for the sex they just had. And so he lifted up the vase and hit him over the head and killed him. To try and win the court case in an adversarial court model, which is the dominant justice response our society has, sadly, he denied that he tried to use homosexual panic, saying that he was just defending himself against a person who'd had sex with him. There were some very brave people who also used the Roma Street beat who saw that man's photo in the newspaper and said, "This man can't use homosexual panic as a defence for murder. We've seen him at the beat having sex before." And so they came out of their anonymous safety of using the beat and being anonymous to say, "We want to value people and value life enough to be honest to say we can't use lies to solve problems." And it turned out that he was a gay man who'd gone home with another gay man and had sex that was consensual, but he couldn't accept it, and the denial meant that he hated himself and felt that he was worthless because of internalised homophobia from his religious beliefs. He'd grown up in a Baptist family, and I name the religion. I don't say that's the only religion that has those views. I come from a Seventh-day Adventist background. I had internalised homophobia that I didn't feel valuable as well. But that's very toxic, because now he believed that he was a bad person and not a valuable person because of wanting to connect in a loving way with another person. My patient, who was sharing his cell with him, made such a friendship with him that he could now afford to be honest about the fact that he hated himself for being gay, and he could now come out of the denial and the dependency on power that resulted in the murder. And all the people who've ever threatened to kill me, the best way to get safety is to turn that person into a friend, where we can value each other, retaining the right for each person to be honest about limits and boundaries and choices, so that now we can have the safety of equality and respect rather than the false safety of power and a wall that can be broken down. I notice that I'm running out of time. I could go on about all the different ways that we use each other. We could manipulate each other. We could be dependent on each other, where we just say yes so people like us. We could find ourselves being the fix-it person who has to always rescue other people, being strong at the expense of being honest, wearing each other and wearing out and wondering how we can keep going. Caring is, I accept you, I'll be honest with you, you can be honest with me, and we both be honest, we can be honest together. And so caring includes honesty. Wearing means I sacrifice honesty and feel I have to please you and say yes for you and pay for all your consequences and have answers for every problem. And when I can't fix you, I feel a failure, and so I feel like to reject you. Our role is not to run someone else's life, and one of the most efficient things I've learned to do is that I can't change other people. I can accept them, and I can be honest for me, but I can't be honest for them. And I can make choices for me, but I can't make choices for them. And if you feel you have to fix your child or change your child will not feel accepted. They'll know your beliefs, and they'll be very good at hiding from you. And so if you say simply, "I accept you, you can be honest with me," we reverse the dynamics so that then we foster the honesty that allows the learning to happen sooner rather than later. Otherwise, people feel bad when they're not meeting our expectations. They hide from us, deny what they're doing, and do it again. And this is very relevant when it comes to drug issues. People use drugs to feel good, and we learn by experimenting. We learn from our own experiments. If we can be honest, we probably learn early. If we can't be honest and we hide what we're doing, we probably get stuck, and so we get addicted. Or if we don't learn from our own experiments, we might learn from someone else's experiments. And if we trust that person or the book they wrote, we can benefit from learning from each other's experiences. If we're going to foster relationships where we foster learning and we learn from each other and we can talk to each other, we can learn in less painful ways than just experimenting on our own. And so we can perhaps experiment and talk and live rather than experiment and hide and die. And so again, I'm saying very simply, if you could accept your kid enough that they could be honest with you and you could be honest with them about the dead ends you've been down, you know, "I've been down that dead end. I know it's a dead end. If you want to talk about it, let's talk about it," rather than hiding our past mistakes and feeling we have to be so perfect that we see it, the child sees us as unapproachable. Again, I say clearly, this isn't about the goodies and the baddies. This is about learning the shortcuts that don't meet our needs versus the through roads that may be painful but let us bond together and love each other and connect with each other so that we don't have to go outside those relationships and learn by the pain of experimenting on our own, taking the risk that can result in HIV and AIDS, the risk that can result in addiction, the risk that can result in us feeling worthless if we can't meet expectations and be very vulnerable to suicide. Thanks for listening. I'll open it for questions.